This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqara, recited by Ali Pariskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalu alladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون فلا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: the U.S. embassy in Iraq comes under a rocket attack hours after drones and missiles targeted two bases hosting American troops in western and northern Iraq. The Israeli military blows up the house of a Palestinian prisoner near the city of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. And the UN Security Council condemns the assassination of Haiti's president and calls on all parties to avoid any act that could contribute to further instability. Hello and welcome, everybody. The U.S. Embassy inside Baghdad's Green Zone has been targeted with several rockets. That's the third attack against American installations in Iraq in the past 24 hours. Iraqi security forces said the embassy's anti-rocket system diverted one of the projectiles while one fell near the zone's perimeter. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, yet the strike came hours after rockets hit Ain al-Assad Air Base, a military installation in western Iraq that houses U.S. troops. Early Wednesday, security forces said armed drones hit a U.S. base at Erbil Airport in the northern Kurdistan region.
Iraq's Ain al-Assad Air Base hosting American forces has come under a fresh rocket attack. A spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq said two personnel were injured after more than a dozen missiles targeted the facility. Less than a day earlier, a U.S. base at Erbil Airport in northern Kurdistan region was targeted as well. Security sources in Erbil said armed drones were used in the attack, which prompted the suspension of flights at the airport. These incidents are nothing new. Supply convoys for the U.S.-led military coalition in Iraq have come under repeated attacks over the past months. Anti-American sentiments have been on the rise since Washington's assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes in January last year. Shortly after the killing of the two iconic anti-terror figures, the Iraqi parliament unanimously voted to end the American military presence. The legislation has fallen on deaf ears as the United States seems unwilling to leave the Arab country. On the ground, things look simple. The Iraqis do not want American troops on their soil. Why is it, then, one may ask, that the U.S. refuses to end its costly intervention there?
They are, you know, pretending to fight the Islamic State or Daesh, but reality is they've been funding it, supporting it, and bringing in members of the Al-Qaeda, which means the database, into Syria and to Iraq as a way of destabilizing the area and to create opportunities for the Americans.
The United States, that had invaded Iraq before, sent thousands of new troops there in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh terrorists. Baghdad declared victory over the terror group in 2017, but Washington has shown no sign of intending to leave the oil-rich nation. The U.S. cites the continued threat of Daesh as the reason for its long, drawn-out stay in Iraq, but what it's done over the past years put its stated purpose in question. Washington has regularly launched attacks on the positions of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, an umbrella organization which was the key in defeating Daesh. Such strikes have been strongly condemned by Iraqi political and military figures, as well as the public, who regard the U.S. military presence as the main source of tensions in the country.
Elsewhere, Israel has demolished the house of a Palestinian prisoner in the occupied West Bank. The house of Muntasir Shalabi, located near the city of Ramallah, was blown up by Israeli forces in the early hours of Thursday. Israel says Shalabi carried out a second drive-by shooting in the West Bank that killed an Israeli and wounded two others. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed the demolition, calling it a barbaric and a terrorist behavior practiced by criminal gangs. An Israeli court approved the demolition of the house last month in line with its policy of demolishing the family homes of attackers after they are killed or arrested. Rights groups have time and again slammed this policy and say it violates international laws. Well, the specter of the recent Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip continues to haunt the residents of the impoverished enclave. Our correspondent in Gaza, Ruba Shavit, has more in this report.
For 11 continuous days, Palestinian civil services and medical teams were working round the clock to save the lives of many Palestinians during the Israeli relentless bombardment of the Gaza Strip. We talked with a number of members from the civil defense services and medical teams who talked with us about their hard times during the escalation.
The latest escalation was different from the previous ones. Israeli airstrikes targeted civilians in their homes with no prior notice. We suffered from facility shortage and had no way but to use very preliminary tools to remove the victims from the rubble of their homes. What made the mission more devastating for us was that sometimes we couldn't find the people caught under the rubble.
Israeli airstrikes also targeted the main road to the largest hospital in Gaza and other roads in an attempt to prevent medics and civil teams from reaching people. Faris Afana told us about his emotional and practical struggle while saving civilians' lives during Israeli bombardment.
Sometimes we received phone calls from the families of the victims who were in desperate need, and it was really risky for us to reach them. But despite the dangers, our men went out to offer services to the victims. Thanks God, we managed to pull many people out of the rubble. We lost some of our best friends during the rescue operations. Most of our facilities were also damaged in Israeli aggression.
The Palestinian civil defense in Gaza is already working under pressure amid severe shortage of medical resources due to continuous wars and a 15-year blockade. They call on the international community to put pressure on Israel to allow entrance of risky equipment into the impoverished enclave.
It is hard to describe the dire situation of Palestinians during the recent escalation in Gaza. Sometimes our men were playing with death as Israel made no distinction between the military and civilian targets. We call on the international community to put pressure on Israel to stop these attacks against civilian targets.
Israel's recent war on Gaza has left hundreds of Palestinians dead and many others wounded, sparking harsh criticism from the international community. Civil defense services, along with medical teams in Gaza, insist on fully doing their work, saving lives, especially amid hot times and the shortage of equipment, amid the silence of the international community. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
The anti-Iran terror group Mojahedin Khalis set to hold its annual conference again in Paris, despite the COVID crisis. The French authorities allow the group to gather in the Paris suburb. Why does France authorize them to have a meeting when at the same time desires to strengthen its ties with Iran. Our correspondent in Paris has more.
The anti-Iran Mujahideen, a Kalak organization considered by many as a dangerous terrorist organization, will hold its annual meeting in Paris on Saturday. The notorious Cairn Academic Edition House, a kind of think tank for universities, published a study about the National Council of Resistance of Iran, NCRI, the umbrella organization of the NKO, with as conclusion, according to objective criteria, the NCRI is without any doubt a sectarian organization. The NKO is, among others, accused of separating children from their parents. So why do French authorities allow them to organize their annual conference?
If Mariam Rajavi is still in France and they still have their rallies every now and then in Paris, it means that the French want to be on both sides of the fence, like all the Europeans. France has an interest of having good relations with Iran. They had Total, which had invested a lot of money then, they'd probably want to go back.
In previous meetings of the NKO in Paris, the group had actively lobbied to obtain the support of mayors and members of parliament. The most visible support comes from French Member of Parliament Habib Meir, who has the double nationality, Israeli and French. He participates even in marches from the NKO here in 2016. Is there a link between Israel and the NKO terrorist organization?
Mujahideen have been linked closely to Israel. You have a report by two high officials from the CIA, which was publicized by the NBC radio in 2012, which said that the operations to assassinate the scientists and any other clandestine operations, terrorist operations inside Iran, were being planned or had been planned by the Israeli Secret Service and executed by members of the Mujahideen. So the Mujahideen have been working with the Israeli Secret Services ever since that time.
Also, important USA officials spoke at the conference. John Bolton, a former USA National Security Advisor, Rudolph Giuliani, former mayor of New York, and they received money. USA speakers received $25,000. French speakers received $12,500. Media reports say that the money comes from the CIA, from Mossad, but mainly from Saudi Arabia. Experts say that European Union countries, and France in particular, want to eat from both sides. They tolerate the terrorist group on their territory and seek better relations with Iran, especially for economic reasons. It's not sure that this can work. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
Now, Swahishin police say they've killed four people and arrested two others from a group allegedly behind the assassination of the country's president, Jovenel Moïse. The director general of national police said three policemen who were taken hostage by assailants have also been recovered. He, however, did not specify the identity of the armed men who attacked Moïse's residence on the outskirts of the capital, Port-au-Prince, fatally killing him and injuring the first lady early on Wednesday. Interim Prime Minister Claude Joseph has already declared a national state of siege and announced being in charge of the country. The UN Security Council has condemned the assassination of Haiti's head of state. In a statement, the council urged calm and called on political stakeholders to refrain from any acts of violence. Political commentator Nicolas Ayala says the sequence of events unfolding in the immediate aftermath of Moise's assassination points to a power grab by the country's right-wing forces.
Now, it seems to be Claude, if we look at the new acting Prime Minister Claude Joseph, who was a former member of the GNB, which was a student movement which participated in the 2004 coup against Aristide, it seems to be that those right-wing oligarchic forces that were part of the overthrow of Aristide back in 2004 are attempting to seize power in Haiti and have essentially pushed out Moise, who lost a lot of his support from the oligarchic class after the large uprising we saw in Haiti in February. So it seems to be a power play by certain segments of the Haitian ruling class in order to really consolidate their control. The state of siege that you mentioned really kind of reaffirms that idea, because what that essentially means is that the army is taking over the policing matters of the country, the media is being taken over by the state, and other very repressive measures. The fear now is that they may attempt to call for another UN occupation of Haiti, which, as we remember from last time, went very poorly for the Haitian people. and really meant more repression, more deaths, and more destruction for the island.
South Africa's former president Jacob Zuma has turned himself over to the police to serve 50 months in jail for contempt of court. Zuma's foundation said the former president has decided to comply with the incarceration order. A police spokesman confirmed Zuma was in the care of the security forces in compliance with a constitutional court sentence. Last month, the constitutional court sentenced Zuma for defying an instruction earlier this year to give evidence at a corruption inquiry. Zuma had earlier asked the court to annul his sentence on the grounds that it's excessive and could expose him to COVID-19. The former president is accused of graft and corruption during his tenure between 2009 and 2018. Zuma rejects all allegations as being politically motivated. And Sudan has condemned Ethiopia for starting the next phase of filling the controversial mega dam on the Nile River, considering it a clear violation of international law. Press TV correspondent in Khartoum, Mohamed Ali Fezari, has more in this report.
Sudan condemns Ethiopia's start of second phase of filling the controversial Nile Dam, warning the move violates existing agreements and threatens security in the region. The warning came after Sudan's Minister of Irrigation and Water Resources received a letter from Ethiopian counterpart informing him of the start of the second filling of the dam during the current rainy season. Despite drums of war appear, the government of Sudan rule out any military solution to resettle the situation.
I think the military option, to my understanding, is out of question. It's not going to happen, especially for Sudan, because the battle will be in Sudan. And maybe Ethiopia will retaliate if they attack Gerd. Maybe they are going to retaliate in Osiris Dam or anywhere else. And the areas there will be affected. So, and this is not the solution.
Experts insist that no other option rather than negotiation within the international law is available for Sudan.
The National Court of Justice, which is an organ of the United Nations, according to its rules, no country can take another country to that court unless the country has already agreed to go before the International Court of Justice, and definitely Syria would not agree to that. So there is no international legal channel available to the government of Sudan.
Last month, Sudan and Egypt had sent a letter asking the UN Security Council to take up the issue. Talks mediated by the African Union, most recently in the Democratic Republic of Congo, have repeatedly stalled. According to Sudanese authorities, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is being built about 15 kilometers from border with Sudan on the Blue Nile, the source of most of the Nile's water, yet it affects life of 20 million people in this area.
As experts say, with the starting the next phase of filling the controversial mega dam on the Nile River by Ethiopia, the ball is now on the court of Sudan and Egypt. But as things stand, the two countries are still waiting for an action by the UN. Mohamed Ali Fezari, Khartoum.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy.
He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
In the limelight.
Conservative MPs are becoming increasingly anxious that the long-awaited health and care bill, which involves the biggest shakeup of the National Health Service, NHS, in England in a decade, could become a damaging political drama, make people question Tory handling of the NHS, and prove a gift to Labour, which recently called for the bill to be scrapped. Here we present you an article concerning this issue written jointly by Dennis Campbell and Aubrey Allegretti under the heading, Johnson to announce controversial plans for greater NHS control. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is set to spark a political row in coming days by announcing plans to seize greater control of the NHS, despite warnings that the power grab will see ministers blamed for delays in treatment and closure of local hospital units. The Prime Minister has told the new Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, to put the long-awaited health and care bill before Parliament, despite Javid's own misgivings and concerns among hospital bosses and doctors' leaders. Conservative MPs are becoming increasingly anxious that the bill, which involves the biggest shake-up of the NHS in England in a decade, could become a damaging political drama, make people question Tory handling of the NHS and prove a gift to Labour, which recently called for the bill to be scrapped. Javid is expected to lay the bill before Parliament after the Prime Minister overruled his plea to delay its introduction until the autumn. Johnson has told Matt Hancock's successor to press ahead with the legislation despite Jarvis' concern that it will prove controversial and involves significant areas of contention which have yet to be resolved. The health secretary's new powers would enable him to abolish NHS arm-length bodies and intervene much earlier in deciding if an A&E or maternity unit deemed unsafe over staffing problems, for example, had to shut. Hospital bosses have voiced serious concern to The Guardian about the government's plan to hand Javid such a big new powers of direction. The NHS Confederation and NHS Providers, the two groups which represent health service trust, both warned that this could allow ministers to wield undue influence over the NHS and reduce its independence. Matthew Taylor, the Confederation's chief executive, said health services chiefs were broadly supportive of the bill, which seeks to undo some of the most damaging effects of the last Tory overhaul of the NHS, then Health Secretary Andrew Lansley's Health and Social Care Act 2012. But Taylor added that they remain concerned that some of the proposals could lead to heavy-handed ministerial involvement in day-to-day matters affecting the NHS, such as the closing or opening of new services for patients, which could go against the advice and expertise of local leaders who know what is best for their communities. Taylor noted we can't risk playing political football with the NHS given the challenges it faces. NHS providers cautioned that the health secretary's beefed up powers could lead to service chiefs nationally and locally coming under political pressure or interference. Saffron Cordery, its deputy chief executive, said, "There is no suggestion here that a publicly funded service like the NHS should not be held to account. Rather, that the strategic direction is the domain of politicians who should then allow the people involved in operational and clinical roles with day-to-day responsibility for supporting patient care the space to deliver those strategic objections without undue political pressure or interference. The bill will replace the clinical commissioning groups, Lansley's reforms created, with new bodies known as integrated care systems, regional groupings of providers of different sorts of healthcare working with their counterparts in social care." Ben Howlett, a former Tory MP who is now managing director of the Public Policy Project think tank, warned Johnson that the move could backfire. Howlett said as a result of the new Health and Care Act, ministers will no longer need to horse trade with NHS bosses to set priorities as the Secretary of State makes himself directly accountable for the provision of services. Howlett added MPs will for the first time in over a decade find constituents asking why there are long waiting lists and poor cancer outcomes without being able to write to NHS England Chief Executive Simon Stevens for answers. "My advice to the new Secretary of State, beware the law of unintended consequences." One health policy expert who asked not to be named said, "Politically, this bill is a tricky sell, even though the government has an 80-seat majority. The penny is dropping among MPs that there is more in the bill than just boring technocratic NHS issues." He said, "How does this bill help tackle by NHS challenges like waiting times and chronic understanding? It doesn't. That may become a problem. The bill, which only relates to the NHS in England, does include plans to reduce some privatization by removing the duty on the NHS to put care contracts out to tender. However, the British Medical Association, the Doctors Union, warned that it could lead to the new integrated care system, ICSEs,
offering large contracts to private firms without any tendering process. And I repeat, the Tory cronies scandal involving bills of pounds of deals for personal protective equipment, PPE, for NHS staff, seen during the COVID pandemic. Dr. David Riley, the MBA's deputy chair of council, said, "We're concerned that private health providers like Virgin Care could be given seats on the boards of ICS and therefore potentially be involved in deciding who gets what contracts. And we are very concerned that the bill could mean that contracts are just handed out to the private sector without a tendering process." The bill is the first of a series of important decisions that Javed, who is barely a week into his new role as the boss of the Department of Health and Social Care, will have to take in the next fortnight. Sajid Javid and the board of NHS England are close to deciding who will succeed Stevens, who is stepping down this month after more than 7 years in the job. Ministers want his replacement to have a much lower profile and not cause trouble by regularly lobbying in the public for the NHS to be given more money and the government to radically reform social care as Stevens has done. The new NHS boss, whoever it is, will have significantly less power than wielded by Stevens as a result of the legislation. Reports on Sunday, July 4th, said that Javid had ruled out Dido Harding, the Tory peer who runs the government's heavily criticized test and trace program. NHS bosses hope that will help clear the way for Amanda Pritchard, Stevens' deputy, who is widely admired in the service after his stint running Guy's and St. Thomas Hospital Trust in London. Sir James Mackey, the chief executive of the Northumbria Healthcare Trust, is also seen as a strong contender. Javed Johnson and the Chancellor Rishi Sunak also have to decide imminently whether to increase the government's 1% pay offer to NHS staff, which health unions have described a pathetic and insult. The Royal College of Nursing is gearing up to hold its first ever ballot of its 450,000 strong membership for possible strike action. The NHS pay review body submitted its recommendations to Javid recently. It is thought to have advised that staff deserve more like a 2% increase, especially after the widely praised efforts during the COVID pandemic. However, the Royal College of Nursing, RCN, is demanding 12.5%.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
10 minutes.
US troops are already heading home from Afghanistan, putting an end to a two-decade-long war that saw as many as 100,000 American troops there. The withdrawal of the remaining few thousand is to be complete by the symbolic date of September 11, 2021. Now, the Taliban is advancing ahead of the drawdown. It has reached the gates of Kunduz, far from its traditional base in the south, seeking to regain power in the country after 20 years. On April 14th, U.S. President Joe Biden announced one of his biggest decisions since he came to office.
I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility on to a fifth.
Biden delivered his address in the White House Treaty Room, where George W. Bush announced the U.S.-led attack on Afghanistan back in 2001.
On them, or we need somebody else to maneuver on them.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. These carefully targeted actions are designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime.
Between these two statements lie 20 years of war and terror. The chief U.S. goal was to hunt down Osama bin Laden. The U.S. had determined that bin Laden and his network were responsible for the September 11th attacks. But there was never a clear exit strategy, even after the Americans killed bin Laden in May 2011 in Pakistan. U.S. combat operations officially began in early October 2001, with airstrikes against Al-Qaeda training camps and Taliban military installations. Under pressure from American air power and an anti-Taliban coalition of Afghans and tribal leaders, the Taliban government collapsed in December. The U.S. flatly refused to negotiate with the toppled officials, sowing seeds for new waves of violence and terror. In the words of Afghanistan expert Ibrahim Bahis, once you have overthrown a force that was ruling over the country and replaced it with a disparate group of actors with diverging priorities and capabilities, seems like there really is very little choice other than to engage in some ways to keep the country from falling apart. The war the Americans staged in Afghanistan was, to a great degree, a serious attempt to undo what they had done in the heat of the Cold War. In the early 1980s, the Americans trained, armed, and financed assorted Afghan Arab groups who fought under the umbrella name of Mujahideen against the occupying Soviet forces. The Afghan Arab fighters later transformed into more distinguished groups, such as the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. By the time Soviet forces retreated from the country in 1989, the Taliban had become a powerful group, and by 1996, they held power over roughly three-quarters of Afghanistan. In short, Washington's aim was to tame the creations of its policy that had run amok. But taming the group was easier said than done, costly, bloody, and almost impossible. Brown University's Costs of War project has also estimated that U.S. military expenses in Afghanistan have exceeded $2.26 trillion. According to the UN Assistance Mission to Afghanistan, over the past 12 years, over 111,000 civilians have been killed or injured. Besides the Taliban, international troops have also killed many innocent civilians, especially when attacking villages with fighter jets and drones. The Afghans have had to bear the brunt of Washington's strategic mistakes and miscalculations. At the same time, the resurgent Taliban now control or contest more territory than at any time since the war began, ignoring calls for a ceasefire or at least a reduction in violence.
More than 50 of Afghanistan's 370 districts have fallen since the beginning of May. Most districts have been taken surround provincial capitals, suggesting that the Taliban are positioning themselves to try and take these capitals once foreign forces are fully withdrawn.
Against such a backdrop, Biden's promise to leave Afghanistan for good, regardless of the conditions on the ground, has lessened the incentive for the Taliban to make concessions as the group sees itself the winner of the war. In other words, the Taliban have achieved one of their main goals, the unconditional withdrawal of international troops.
The administration has decided to abandon U.S. efforts in Afghanistan, which have helped keep radical Islamic terrorism in check. And bizarrely, they've decided to do so by September the 11th. Apparently, we're to help our adversaries ring in the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks by gift-wrapping the country and handing it right back to them. Unfortunately, this mistake in Afghanistan is one of several instances of this new administration surrendering leverage without making America, our allies, or our interests more secure.
Living in a time line where we are not anywhere with the negotiations, or we haven't received an agreement with the Taliban, would not be responsible, and it would can cost us losing everything we worked and fought together in the past 20 years, and that can risk overall security in Afghanistan. So that's why I think the extension is a responsible approach for what's happening here now in Afghanistan.
When the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in October 2001, the country was an isolated, devastated country under the Taliban's control. Two decades later, the country has not found peace and is marked with deep social and economic divisions. More than half of the population continues to live in abject poverty.
It's very naive to think that Americans came here to do anything with poverty, to do anything with peace building, to do anything with democracy or human rights. It's, in fact, it's the other way around. The American presence, not in Afghanistan, but in the region and in the world, in the bigger picture, is to create more conflict, is to create more poverty, is to create more dependency to the United States.
The contested areas in the south and east of the country, the heartland of the Taliban, are in bad shape after bearing the brunt of Western firepower. Experts say escalating violence and the COVID-19 pandemic could push the poverty rate from nearly 50% to over 70%. Meanwhile, U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded that the Afghan government could collapse within 6 months of the departure of the last international troops. U.S. troops leaving Afghanistan seems to be more than a mere withdrawal. The Americans are in fact running away from Afghanistan, shirking responsibility of cleaning up the mess they've left behind over the past two decades. In a war that has run for more than 20 years, longer than World War I, World War II, and the Korean War combined, the U.S. military in the end tasted humility while leaving the Afghans all to their own devices.
But we don't have a good history of taking care of those who sided with us in conflict and making sure that if they feel they cannot sustain themselves in their country or unwilling to do so, that we take care of them. And that sends a global message. Don't fight with the Americans, because when they're finished, they leave you behind. That's not something we can tolerate.
Will Afghanistan go back to square one when the Taliban were in power? And if so, who is to be blamed?
Yeah.
In the Limelight.
Eric Adams, a former police captain, has won the Democratic primary for mayor of New York City after appealing to the political center and promising to strike the right balance between fighting crime and ending racial injustice in policing. Eric Adams would be the city's second black mayor if elected. He triumphed over a large field in New York's first major race to use ranked choice voting. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Adam Gabbat and Manvi Singh. The piece is titled, Ex-Police Captain Eric Adams Wins Democratic Primary for New York Mayor. Eric Adams, a former police captain, has won the Democratic primary for mayor of New York City after appealing to the political center and promising to strike the right balance between fighting crime and ending racial injustice in policing. Eric Adams would be the city's second black mayor if elected. He triumphed over a large field in New York's first major race to use ranked choice voting. As of Tuesday evening, 6th of July, Eric Adams had a lead of 1 percentage point over his closest rival, Catherine Garcia, according to the latest count of ballots. The Associated Press declared Adams the winner of the race shortly after a new round of vote totals was released. I grew up poor in Brooklyn and Queens. I wore a bulletproof vest to keep my neighbors safe. I served my community as a state senator and Brooklyn borough president, Eric Adams said in a statement shared on Twitter. And I'm honored to be the Democratic nominee to be the mayor of the city I've always called home. Tuesday's updated vote count included some 125,000 absentee ballots. In-person and early votes were previously published on 29th of June, when Adams had the lead. The winner of the Democratic primary is likely to win the mayoral election proper in November, given the left-leaning politics of the city and an unheralded Republican opponent. Curtis Sliwa, a talk show host and founder of the Guardian Angels Volunteer Crime Prevention Group, won the Republican primary. Eric Adams' closest vanquished rivals included Catherine Garcia, the former New York City Sanitation Commissioner, who campaigned as a technocrat and proven problem solver, and a former City Hall legal advisor, Maya Wiley, who had progressive support, including an endorsement from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Andrew Yang, the 2020 presidential candidate known for his proposed universal basic income, was an early favorite in the race, but faded as the race progressed. Eric Adams, a 60-year-old, is a moderate Democrat who opposed the Defund the Police movement. We're not going to recover as a city if we turn back time and see an increase in violence, particularly gun violence, Adams said after three people, including a four-year-old child, were shot and wounded in Times Square in May. If black lives really matter, it can't only be against police abuse. It has to be against the violence that's ripping apart our communities, he told supporters on the night of the primary. Eric Adams speaks frequently of his dual identity as a 22-year police veteran and a black man who endured police brutality himself as a teenager. He said he had been beaten by police officers at the age of 15. He became a police officer in 1984 and rose to the rank of captain before leaving to run for the state senate in 2006. While in the police department, he co-founded 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care, a group that campaigned for criminal justice reform and against racial profiling. After winning a state senate seat from Brooklyn in 2006, Eric Adams became one of New York's most famous politicians. Adams also weathered a few controversies, including a 2010 report from the state inspector general that faulted his oversight of the bidding process to bring casino gambling to the Aqueduct racetrack in Queens. Adams had accepted campaign contributions from a politically connected group bidding for the gambling franchise. Adams was elected in 2013 as Brooklyn Borough President, his current job. New York City's first experience with ranked choice voting in a major election was bumpy. The New York City Board of Elections invited fresh criticism on Tuesday when it published the results after 7 p.m. local time, having earlier pledged to reveal the totals at brunch hours. The delay came after the board managed to plunge the Democratic primary race into chaos last week, when it mistakenly included 135,000 test ballots in its vote tally. The mistake showed Catherine Garcia, New York's former sanitation commissioner, narrowing the gap on Eric Adams, the Brooklyn Borough president, to less than 2 percentage points. Hours later, however, the Board of Elections said it had become aware of a discrepancy in its report. The Elections Board said its calculations had included both test and election night results, producing approximately 135,000 additional records. The error sowed confusion around the system of ranked choice voting, which was used for the first time in New York City mayoral election this year. Eric Adams, Catherine Garcia, and Maya Wiley all filed lawsuits last week seeking the right to review the ranked choice tally. Maya Wiley said in a statement on Tuesday that the board must be completely remade following what can only be described as a debacle. As for herself, she said her campaign would have more to say soon about next steps. On Tuesday morning, 6th of July, as voters speculated as to when the second batch of results would be released, the Board of Elections had adopted a glib tone on its Twitter feed. "We promise today's release is more brunch special versus club hours," the Board of Electors tweeted. That tweet was sent at 8:48 a.m., but it was well past most people's definition of brunch hours by the time the results were finally released.
Reports released by some whistleblowers indicate that a number of young Saudis are on death row for participating in anti-government protests in Eastern Province. Since 2011, the province has been the scene of peaceful demonstrations by Shia Muslims against social and political, as well as economic and religious discrimination. According to Saudi leaks, the Saudi authorities are planning to execute dozens of teenagers from the Shia-populated Qatif region in Eastern Province for their participation in peaceful protests against the regime. More than 40 teenagers now face the death penalty only because they took part in pro-democracy rallies in 2011 or later.
I guess the Saudis, that's their career, that's their behavior for behaving in a very strange and barbaric manner against these people in eastern and in southern part in Saudi Arabia, especially the opposition people who try or who dare to challenge the Saudi despotic regime.
The report came less than a week after Saudi authorities executed 26-year-old Shia Muslim Mustafa al-Darwish. Al-Darwish was arrested in May 2015 on protest-related charges when he was 17 years old. He was executed on June 15 in Dammam, according to a statement issued by the Saudi Ministry of Interior.
The Saudis, they treat the people in Saudi Arabia in an atrocious manner, and they think that they are slaves for them. They use them and they prevent them from the most simplest rights in that place.
According to Reprieve, al-Darwish was placed in solitary confinement and beaten so badly that he lost consciousness several times. To make the torture stop, he confessed to the charges against him. In fact, al-Darwish is the latest victim of Riyadh's deeply flawed justice system, which regularly sees people sentenced to death after unfair trials. He was a member of the marginalized Shia Muslim majority in the region of Latif, an oil-rich region with deprived inhabitants.
The Shias in Saudi Arabia, in the Arabian Peninsula, whether in Bahrain or in Arabian Peninsula, they have been treated manly in a very harsh manner also. But also other people of the Muslims and also Christians, any human want to be in a position side against this medievalist regime, this backward regime, I guess they have certain kind of treatment, harsh, like trying to belittle or trying to do even kill others.
Saudi Arabia is known as a world leader in capital punishment and has conducted several mass executions. In 2019, the kingdom executed 37 men, most of them Shia, convicted in unfair trials.
The High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, today strongly condemned the beheading of 37 men in spite of repeated appeals by UN Human Rights System about the lack of due process and fair trial guarantees, allegations that confessions were obtained through torture, and the age of some of those executed. According to available information, at least three of those executed were minors at the time they were sentenced. And the UN Human Rights Office now says that most of the 37 belonged to Shia Muslim minority. Some had also been involved in protests.
Faced with international pressure, Saudi King Salman decreed last year that crimes committed by minors, that's anyone under 18, would no longer be punished by death. In March 2021, the death sentences of some of the high-profile men such as Ali al-Nimr, Dawood al-Marhoun, and Abdullah al-Zahir were changed accordingly. They were between the ages of 15 and 17 when they were first arrested.
The reform, when you give the freedom to the people, not imprison them for just they are so and so politically or culturally even or religiously, I guess this is a backwardness, and I don't think this kind of mind, of mentality, it would be very, not only difficult, it would be impossible to say that they would bring reform. Reformation, first of all, means to change your mentality, and well, we don't see that.
Yet the punishment remains possible for men like Abdullah al-Huwaidi for crimes they allegedly committed as children. More than 26,000 people have signed a reprieve petition to prevent his execution.
This kind of regime with no legislative body, no constitution, no election, and nothing of what's so-called in this modern world about the freedom and liberty. And I guess it's about now for the international community to bring this regime into justice instead of this regime to bring all these people and execute them, especially the teenagers who really need to go to the schools, to the universities, and to be encouraged in this life. On the contrary, they put them down in order to belittle them and to do all the bad things to them.
Where is the justice? Al-Huwaidi's mother tweeted in Arabic on June 16. We call on the relevant authorities to intervene and save the innocent.